The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. We are in this gorgeous, I mean, is it a tasting room? Is it an estate room? This is beautiful at Santa Bonhof in Moselle with the owner and the winemaker, Nick Weiss. Nick, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
You're very welcome.
So let's just start. Actually, you know what? Describe the room we're in. This room is beautiful.
Well, this is our tasting room where most of our tastings happen, whether it is with customers or the tastings that I do with my cellar master, with my team here, when we taste through the wines, barrel samples, and so on. It's kind of the center of the winery, if you want so.
And where in the Moselle, where are your grapes? Can we see any of them from where we are sitting here?
Yes, the winery is surrounded by our own vineyards. We have about 8 hectares of vineyards located right around the estate in all 4 directions as you look out the windows. The winery is located in a little town called Leuven, and it's located between Trier and Bernkastel-Kues. Mm-hmm. Trier is the oldest city of the Mosel, and also the oldest city of Germany. It was founded 17 before Christ, and Bernkastel is a little medieval town. The two cities are about 50 kilometers apart as you drive along the river, and Leuven, our town here, is located right in the middle between Trier and Bernkastel on the right riverside. We're about half an hour, 35 minutes east of Luxembourg, to give you the geography.
And it's funny, us driving here from Bernkastel, it feels like in every little town, every other shop is a vinotech like this. Like for people that want to do wine tourism, it's hard to recommend a place more beautiful than what we've been driving in the last 2.5 days.
The Mosel is a river wine region, as I call it, a valley region. Most wine regions, I think, are beautiful regions. And the Mosel in particular, because the Mosel Valley is a very windy valley. The river has a lot of bends, a strong meander. It flows over a distance of 220 kilometers from the border of Luxembourg, France, and Germany towards northeast, where it ends in the Rhine, a little bit south of Cologne, at a town called Koblenz. And all along the river, people are doing viticulture for almost 2,000 years. The Romans came here and planted the first vines. Some historians say that even the Celtics, the Germanic tribes that lived here, were already producing wine, probably from old indigenous vines or grape variety that were growing in the valley.
It's crazy to think about that, because, and we'll talk more in a little bit about Ontario and the connection that you and in this winery has for the Southern Ontario region, but just the idea of thousands of years old, just wine being made from this region. We'll go back just 20 years or so. I'm curious, this winery has been a member of the VDP. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit for the listeners, just the importance of the VDP and the part that you guys play.
Well, the VDP is Germany's oldest vintner or winery association. It's basically a club of wineries, or it's actually a club of the owners of the wineries. It's mm-hmm. a vintner's club, if you want so. And it was first founded in the Mosel in order to auction wine. It was almost like a marketing tool, a marketing convention of mm-hmm. people. And it still exists today. This was more than 100 years ago, so it still exists today. The VDP in Germany, VDP stands for Verband Deutscher Prädikatsweingüter, Association of German predicate wineries. You could also call them prestige wineries because all these wineries are proprietors of some of the best vineyard properties in Germany. And this association has about 200 members in Germany. In the Mosel, there's 31 members, and I'm one of them. And it's a personal membership. You have to get elected to become a member. You need two-thirds of the votes of your peers in the regional chapter of this association. And then you are allowed to carry the grape eagle on the capsule, which is our emblem, our logo.
How cool was that for you? The day you got elected?
It was super cool because I was 29 years old at the time.
Wow.
And
were you one of the younger members at the
time? I was probably the youngest member ever, at least in the Mosel, to be elected into it. And I was very, very proud, I must say, and I'm still very proud to be a member. If you think about it, there are about 3,000 wineries in the Mosel, and only 31 are a member of the VDP. So it's like a per mil of wineries.
Did you think you would join? I wonder, were you ever worried, not because of the quality of what you produce, but, you know, in winemaking is often a very traditional sort of way, and to bring in someone so young, do you think there's anyone that was a little hesitant because of your age?
My father already produced very good wines and earned a lot of praise for his wines. And I think, or I guess, that people were pretty sure that I would continue that legacy. So,
right.
And also, I met with everyone before so they could, you know, get a picture of who I am and how I think. And I, you know, try to socialize with everyone, yeah. So they have a little bit of confidence into my person, into me personally, and into how I'm working. And I think that helped.
As we do the interview, we'll sort of intermix with different wines. What is the first one that you've poured for us?
The first wine is from the most recent vintage, 2021. It's a wine called Schiefer Riesling. Mm-hmm. It's an estate level Riesling. Estate level means that when you're a member of the VDP, you're producing wines of different origin, or let's say a different focus of origin. The estate level means that the wine can come from any parcel that the winery owns.
Okay.
The next level above that would be the village level, Ortswein, VDP Ortswein. That's like in Burgundy, the village level. This wine can come from different single vineyard sites, but they all have to belong to one town. So it's
right.
A town wine, a village wine. And the highest level, well, then above that, there's a equivalent to Premier Cru, which is Erste Lage, VDP Erste Lage, which is a classified vineyard that is classified as very good. And the top vineyards are called Große Lage. It's like Grand Cru, great growth. And that's where you make the single vineyard wines from the highest level. This is the highest level of classification for a vineyard that a vineyard can get. And there's not a whole lot of those vineyard sites. Now, this can come from every vineyard, but in fact, it comes only from steep hills that have the typical slate soil as a terroir. And Schiefer is the German term for schist or for slate. And here in the Mosel, we have a dark blue, highly decomposed slate soil, which gives the wines this salinity, gives it a certain savory character in a finish. And Riesling is a fruit-driven grape variety. And in combination with that savoriness, you get a really, really nice tension into the wine, a really nice flavor profile and structure.
So then this would be considered just a very nice Bourgogne Blanc in essence, if you were going to put
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This would be a Bourgogne Blanc where the vintner has used many grapes from Premier Cru sites, for example.
Okay.
A really good Bourgogne Blanc.
Yeah. Okay, that's fascinating. Just, you know, spicy, salty, tangy orange is what I'm getting on this. So I'm repeating myself, but we've been to a couple of very good producers, and what I appreciate is when the entry level is good, it means you can be excited about what is to come.
I agree.
Yeah. Mm. Also, on a completely side note, you guys have the best spittoons that we've been to. I get so many of these, and they're not that deep, and I'm dribbling it out because I know if I do a full spit, it's going to just go back on me. So on a completely other topic, these ones here certainly are much better than any of the other ones that we have had. I was wondering if you talk just a little bit before we move on to the next wine about the history of this winery.
This winery, where it is today, was founded by my grandfather. My family has been making wine for a very long time, for many generations. We cannot trace it back extremely long time. I can go back as far as like the early 1800s. My family has always been living in the middle of the town here. And after World War II, my grandfather decided to start a nursery, a grapevine nursery, and his old winery that my great-great-grandfather built was too small for that. He didn't have enough space there, and so he decided to move out of the town, build a new winery building and cellars on that little hill here on the southern, on the western side of the town. There was not much here before, so he also thought about a name for that place. My grandfather's name was also Nick Weiss. I'm named after him. He didn't want to call the winery just Weingut Nick Weiss. He wanted to give the place a name. Mm-hmm. So he decided to name it after the Christian patron saint of the winemakers, which is Saint Urban.
There's I did not know that is the patron saint of winemakers, Saint Urban. That makes tons of sense.
There's several saints that, you know, vintners pray to in Europe maybe not just in Europe, for good weather. It has a long tradition here. In France, there's Saint Vincent, mm-hmm. Saint Vincent. Maybe you've seen these Saint Vincent festivals on the 22nd of January in France when they do these marches through mm-hmm. the cities, and they have a statue of Saint Vincent, and it's the same in the German-speaking parts of Europe with Saint Urban.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is it all right to move on to the next wine?
Absolutely.
And we're back. Nick, I want to ask you about how you would describe maybe your father or your grandfather were as winemakers, but I want you to think about that for a second and just tell me about the second wine that you have poured for us today.
Our winery property, or the vineyard property, has sites in the Mosel as well as in the Saar, mm-hmm. The tributary to the Mosel. It's a sub-appellation, a very good sub-appellation, located on a little bit higher elevation, but it represents the most southern tip of the wine region. It's embedded into a middle range mountain chain, which also keeps the environment a bit cooler, even though it's so much further south. We have half of our vineyards in the Mosel and the other half in the Saar. And that's why I'm also presenting you a wine from that part, from the Saar. It's a 2021 as well, and it's called Wiltinger Alte Reben. Wiltinger means from Wiltingen, which is a town in the Saar. And Alte Reben is the German term for old vines. So this vineyard was planted in 1900, the year 1900. And it never got entirely replanted ever since. Usually vintners would replant every 30, 40 years, or maybe every 50 years, depending on, you know, how the shape of the vineyard is, or if there's a lot of vines missing. But a lot of the top producers, and also in the past, and especially in the steep slopes, people were doing something that I call eternal viticulture, which means you don't replant the parcel after 30, 40 years entirely. You just replace vines that have died by a young vine. You always keep the vineyard running. That's what happened in this parcel. It was planted in 1900, and over time, people just replaced single plants. So a lot of the vines that are there are still from the first planting, which means today they're 122 years old, these vines. And that's why it's called Alte Reben. I'm half from the Mosel, half from the Saar as well. My mother is a winemaker from the Saar, from a town called Kansum, and my father was a winemaker here from the Mosel, here from Leiven, where our winery is. So I feel very much like at home in both parts of the region, in the Mosel and in the Saar. And this is a wine that I personally like very, very much. It's a kind of a signature wine that we make, even though this is village level. Mm-hmm. So it's not Grand Cru, but it is basically a single vineyard wine because it comes from a single vineyard site and from one parcel and from a very nice and, like I said, old parcel. But this is a wine that has a lot of character because the soil here is a red slate. It's a brownish red slate that has its color from a certain iron content that gives it that spiciness and the a certain very refined herbal and floral notes in the nose. It's got only 11% alcohol. Still, it tastes quite dry. And with just that little bit of alcohol, it brings really an impressive array of flavors and taste intensity on the palate.
Yeah, I know, it's wonderful. And yeah, I guess by law it's considered Village, but we'll just call it high end Village and go from there. What you know, your memories, I don't know if you have any of your grandfather as a winemaker, and I it's funny with these interviews, I think I'm focusing more on family because everyone that I talk to, they're like, my father was, my grandfather, and for you also your mother was as well, so it's so ingrained within your family. Just What were they like as winemakers? And also, it was such a different time making wine than it is now.
Yes, it was definitely a different time. After World War II, there was quite a strong demand for wine. So people had different goals.
Why was that? Sorry to interrupt for a second. Because I was reading something that after the Second World War, it had a negative impact and that a lot of German wines started to go down this path of just becoming really sweet supermarket wine. But I'd love to know from the impact of the end of the Second World War on Moselle.
Still, even after World War II, let's say in the early 1950s, German wines were still highly regarded and quite demanded. So all the, negative things that came from Germany before and during World War II, all that damage and catastrophe that Germany as a nation caused did not really harm the image of German wines. Mm-hmm. And the demand was still very, very strong. The image and the demand went down much later in the 1970s, 1980s, when Germany produced too much wine and too much bad wine.
Like Australia with Shiraz.
Yes. Well, I think Australian Shiraz today is still higher regarded than German wines at the worst times, let me put it this way, at the most difficult times. Because Germany produced a lot of wines that were way too sweet, that were really not good, and that were also cheap, also made in a cheap way. It was just not enough quality. That doesn't mean that there weren't producers that, without any interruption throughout the time until today, always made great and fantastic wines. But the overall mass of wine that was sold, that was that the average level of quality was just extremely low, and that changed with, let's say, the end of 1990s, early 2000s, when more and more of the younger folks of the younger generation started to improve the quality of the wines, and a different thinking, a different philosophy started to develop amongst German wine producers. But after 1945, first of all, people needed wine, wanted wine, not only in Germany, all over the world, and there wasn't enough production to satisfy the demand. So people, first of all, wanted to make more wine to supply the markets. It was not that much quality thinking. The quality was good because the industrialization of viticulture and winemaking hadn't taken place yet. So people didn't have the tools to overstretch yields to make wine in an industrial way. Also in the cellar, people made good wines and they were struggling to make more wine. That was their goal. Later on, that changed from making less wine and making better wine under my father, for example.
How are you similar? How are you different than your father as a winemaker?
My father was not just a winemaker. He was also a great entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. He was a great nurseryman, and he had a lot of hats on, I must say. He did a lot of things. He was really a pioneer and entrepreneur. He started a winery in Canada, for example. He also worked on, he ran other businesses. Like, he even had a bakery, for example. He founded a stone oven bakery, all
really?
That. So he did a lot of things.
He didn't sleep much, did he?
And he did not sleep much. No, he worked very hard together with my mother, and he was very successful with what he was doing. So he focused not only on one thing, he did many things, and he did them well, I must say. I am focusing very much on wine, on the wine production, and my goal is to produce the highest quality of wines possible here in the Mosel in Germany. Also, I'm trying to make the most authentic wines possible, wines that speak for their origin, that are unique, that wines that you can make in that style only in the Mosel, only in this wine region, and wines that also reflect their nearest geographical origin, like the single vineyard site. All these things are important to me. Wines that have longevity, and I always say, but first of all, wines that make fun to drink, wines
yes.
that are quaffable. Because Mosel, and I'm actually happy that I was born in the Mosel, and that I am allowed to be a winemaker, that I have the opportunity to be a winemaker in the Mosel, because here you can make really wines that unite two things in one. First of all, wines from the Mosel, if they're well made, if they're of good quality, they're very quaffable, they make fun to drink, they're party wines, simply said. That's one side. On the other side, they're very sophisticated. They're very origin-driven. They are very ageable. So they have quite an, in terms of quality, and they're quite high-leveled, but also they almost have a certain intellectual appeal to them. Like, you can really dive into that topic and, get yourself acquainted with all these different single vineyard sites and what they differentiate, what the wines differentiate, depending on where they're from. And that's so fascinating. It's amazing.
It is fascinating. Oh, it's blue slate. Oh, it's red slate. It's higher up on the slope. Oh, it's a little bit lower down, and just what each different thing does. We'll try the next wine, if that's okay. And then you mentioned ageability. I'm curious to ask you about a wine that you've had that's over 120 years old. And we'll get into that in just a moment. And we're back. And before you tell us about this wine, Nick, I was reading about you trying, and I'm going to mispronounce it, as I often do, Trockenbirnerschlösschen. Nah, screwed it up. Trockenbirnerschlösschen. Yep, did it again. From 1893, you were saying you thought it was from 1993. I was wondering if you could tell me about the 120-plus-year-old wine that you got to try.
Well, that was at a tasting. I tried.
By the way, can you pronounce it correctly so at least the listeners can realize how dumb I am?
The word Trockenbirn auslese? Yeah.
Trockenbirnerschlösschen. See, I do lese.
Trockenbirn auslese. It's the German equivalent to the French word sélection de grain noble. It means selection of noble berries, or in the German sense of dried berries, selection of dried berries.
When I'm lazy, I just say TBA.
Yeah.
When I'm a coward, I just say that.
And I think in English, a lot of people would call that a late harvest. But see, this is more than just a late harvest. It's not only a late harvest. It actually doesn't necessarily have to be harvested very, very late at all. Of course, usually you need a certain time of ripeness to be able to have the potential to make a wine like that. First of all, you go and select the most highly ripened and dried berries, berry by berry. They look like raisins, Franken raisins. They're partially, usually affected by the botrytis fungus, which is a noble rot, a noble fungus. Which affects the berry skin and perforates it and makes it permeable, so some of the water of the juice evaporates and you have that concentration effect, so the berries shrink. And also that botrytis adds a certain flavor to the grapes and to the wine, which gives it a nice, spicy, nutty note. Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a way to describe that specialty of a wine. These wines are so rare and so special that I think they do need a special wine. And Germans like their multi-syllable words are put together out of many, many different words and create almost a sentence in one word. But this is the way we do it. This is the way we do it.
And you try, and I just went to my research. A friend served you in 1893 blind, and you were off by a century in terms of how old you thought it was.
That's correct.
That's crazy.
I try to taste as many wines as possible because that is the best education, the best study you can do. Mm-hmm. Always happy when I get invited by friends that are wine collectors and wine lovers, and they say, "Why don't you come over and we taste some wines?" And a lot of them collect quite exceptional wines, wines that are very old, remarkably old. And this tasting was a blind tasting with old German Rieslings, and with this wine everybody was guessing, and we didn't mention the century. We were pretty sure that it was a 1900 something.
Yes.
So somebody said this has got to be a 99, and then the host said no, it's older, and then somebody else said it's 97, and he said no, it's older, and somebody else said 93, and he said yeah, it's correct, it's 93, and we all thought, all right, it's pretty good, 93. Yeah, nice and fresh still. The color is a bit darker than we would expect for a 93. And then he said, yeah, it's a 93, but it's an 1893. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of, we missed it for a century and by a century. And the wine was excellent. It was from the Ruwer, from a winery called Kartäuser Hof in the Ruwer Valley. A very good winery. And the wine showed beautifully. Must have been something like maybe not a Trockenbeeren Auslese, but I guess something like an Auslese. Okay, I think it even said Auslese on the label. It was a fantastic wine, and it's not the only wine of such an age that I've tried. I had the opportunity to taste several of wines of such an age, and it was always a surprise, and it shows how well wines from this region age.
It's why I wanted to bring it up, not to shame you for getting it wrong, because the only shameful thing was me trying to pronounce it correctly, but just, you know, another example of how special this region is, and especially that style of wine, that it can be that old, that it can people of your guys' ilk in terms of the amount of wine you've tried, that everyone can get it wrong. What did you pour for us? What is wine number three that we were having here?
The next wine is we are kind of zooming in into the origin, starting with an estate wine, then moving up to a village level, and now we're in a single vineyard site in a vineyard called Layet, L-A-Y-E-T. Ley is an old German word for slate, so the soil is already carried in the name, and this is a großes Gewächs. We abbreviate it by just saying GG because it's easier.
That you choose to make easy, but other things you keep really difficult.
Trockenbeeren Auslesen, we abbreviate as well. We call it TBA.
I know, I call it TBA.
It's not to be announced. Yeah. It's Trockenbeeren Auslesen. GG means great growth, and in France, people call it Grand Cru, and it means that this wine comes from a vineyard site that has been classified with the highest classification level that a vineyard can get by the VDP. So it's VDP, Große Lage, as we call it, great site, great vineyard site, and the best possible dry wine from such a classified vineyard is called a großes Gewächs, a GG. And it's always dry, and it has to be made from grapes that have at least the sugar content of what we call a Spätlese, mm-hmm. Later harvested wine. It has to be hand-picked. The yield is not allowed to overstep a certain limit of 40 hectoliters per hectare.
And, from that perspective, and sorry to interrupt, because I think the yield thing is so important for people to understand what makes a great wine. And there's a lot of things, but one of them is the yield. Those yield standards, what would they compare in Bordeaux or Burgundy or high-end areas of Spain? Like, is there a way to, so that people listening can understand what that means about your yields?
I think in all wine regions of the world where great wines are produced, the yields that people aim for to produce a great wine are all fairly similar. They're all below 40 or 30 hectoliters per hectare, which is like 4,000 to 3,000 liters per hectare, maybe even less. For a great wine, you just cannot do more. And when I talk about yield per hectare, it's actually not entirely correct, because it's better to talk about yield per vine.
Right.
Because it depends on the yield per hectare depends on how many vines you have planted. If you have a high planting density, you might have a higher overall hectare yield than another parcel with just, let's say, half of the plants on the same surface. So it's a matter of yield per vine, and like half a bottle per vine, that would be a Grand Cru level, you know.
Right. Yeah. This, by the way, this is the most, why is this one more full-bodied? This is one of the more full-bodied Rieslings that we've, that we've had since we arrived in Vienna like 8-9 days ago. This is really, especially in the mid-palate, fairly full-bodied Riesling.
You know, this wine comes from a quite warm vineyard site where the vines are exposed to a lot of energy, sun, and warmth. And especially in our part of Germany, where we are located around the 50th parallel, you have a lot of sunshine, especially during the growing season from April to October, because we're fairly north. 50th parallel is quite north. And on the 21st of June, the longest day or the shortest night, we might have sunshine hours of like maybe 17 hours of sunshine.
By the way, we've noticed that. We're sitting in our Airbnb at like 9:30 at night, 10 at night. We've just come from Canada. We're like, why is it still bright out? Why are we tired? We should be going out. Why are we why are we home now? It's crazy.
Yes, it's because we're so far north. You know, when you're on the North Pole on the 21st of June, it never gets dark. It's always bright. In fact, I did that once. I was very close to the pole.
Really?
In June, and it is really amazing. Like, you're sitting outside at noon at midnight, and you have to wear your sunglasses. It's amazing.
What did you open? What did you bring? What did you open at the North Pole?
Well, a bottle of my wine.
Yeah.
I had a bottle of my wine, and it didn't even freeze because it was warm enough. It was not really at the North Pole. It was like an island or a bunch of islands north of Norway called Svalbard, the town of Longyearbyen. It's very far up there. There's even a restaurant with a fantastic wine cellar where I did a tasting, and usually vintners who go there, they have to sign the wall in that wine cellar that they were there. It was pretty cool. So anyway, when you do viticulture on the 50th parallel, and you do that on a steep slope, you create an exposition to the sun almost similar to the flatland on the equator. You know, when you have when you look at the Earth, how the sun shines on the Earth, on the equator, the sun shines in a right angle on the surface, on the flatland. And so in the right angle, you have the strongest impact of the sun exposure. Now, in the North Pole, it's so cold because the sun only shines by. It doesn't have a grip. It doesn't have an impact. That's why it's so cold. Where we are here in a so-called moderate climate zone, it's somewhere in between. But if you have a steep slope, you create a situation like on the equator, so very warm. Plus, we have all these long sunshine days in the summer during the growing season. So I always say you can't get more sun. So a vineyard like this facing south-southwest, being very steep, covered with dark blue slate soil that attracts the sunlight and keeps it, that creates really a lot of energy in the vineyard. So the grapes get a lot of content, a lot of energy. There's a lot in there. And when you make a wine from these grapes, that shows on the palate. That's why it's so full-bodied. And it's not that this wine has like 14 or 15% alcohol. Not at all. It has only 12%, 12.0% alcohol, not more. But still, there's a lot of power in there.
There is.
And that's actually what Grand Cru, or what a Großes Gewächs, GG, what that means, a wine like that.
St. Catharines, love to hear about Cave Springs. What is the relationship that you guys have with Canada, with Ontario?
Well, first of all, one of my sisters lives in Canada. She's married to a Canadian.
Nice, good, and, she's got good choice there, you know, good taste.
Oh, yes. Yeah, my sister, Anna Weiss Pinacetti, is married to Thomas Pinacetti of Cave Spring Cellars in Jordan in the Niagara Peninsula, which is one of the most esteemed wineries in that area, with fantastic vineyard property on the so-called bench, Niagara bench, beans with bench.
I was there a couple of weeks ago. Gorgeous. Okay. And
right. Yeah.
And it's funny, their specialty is Riesling.
Well, the Pinacetti family was one of the first families to plant vines, especially Riesling vines in Ontario. And actually, those vines came from my father.
Oh.
Because in the early 1970s, there was a group of growers coming to our estate here asking for vine plants, if we would supply them with vine plants, because we also have a nursery. My grandfather founded the first privately held nursery in Rheinland-Pfalz, in our province here in Germany, after World War II. And that nursery still exists today. And when this group of people came over, they were looking for vinifero vines that you can make wine of. So far, at that time, in Ontario, there were only vines for grape juice or jelly produced or grown, like Labrusca or whatever they're called, the Concord grape.
Yeah, the hybrid. Now they want you to call them cold climate varietals.
Okay.
It's a little bit of wine political correctness. They don't like the word hybrid. We know what it is. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Sure. So they thought that it would be a good idea to make wine from vinifera grapes in Canada. And, of course, they were looking for grape varieties that are growing in a cooler region. So they were coming to Germany, and they were looking for nurseries. And that's how they encountered this nursery here and how they got to know my father. And like I said, my father was really a pioneer, and he was somebody who took action and did things. And so he went over to Canada, took a look around, and thought, this is good. Let's try this.
Yeah.
First of all, the first obstacle was to get an import permit for vines, because that was difficult. And he managed to get the proof that his vines are virus-free and that they are of highest phytosanitary standard. And he got the import permit and started to export vines into Canada. And then he also decided to plant his own vineyard to showcase how to make Riesling. He only got the import permit for Riesling. That's all he supplied, was Riesling. So he bought an old horse meadow close to Vineland, also on the Niagara bench, and planted the first vineyards. He named the vineyard St. Urban Vineyard after his estate, St. Urban's Hof. And after a few years, he also added a winery, a wine producing facility, and he named the place Vineland Estates Winery. That winery still exists today, even though we are not the proprietors anymore, and my father has passed away, unfortunately, 2 years ago. The winery is still there. And my sister ran that winery, or was working at that winery for quite a while, and that's how she met her husband, Tom Pinacetti, and that's how, that connection came together. And she still lives in Canada and with her husband and her kids, and but they are both in charge or working at Cave Spring Cellars. So we have that connection to both wineries, Vineland Estates, and also to Cave Spring Cellars. And I do know the Canadian wine world quite well, because I've traveled a lot to Canada. But also, I must say, the vast majority of the Riesling vines that are growing, especially the older vines that are growing in Canada today, all come from one place, and this is where we are sitting here.
Yeah.
They all come from Weingut Nick Weiss St. Obernshof from
Girls,
Leiden.
Give a cheer. Give a cheer. They were. I have if we may try the next wine, but and then I have a follow-up. I have another Ontario question for you, and then we'll come back to the Moselle. We'll start with the noise I just made. This what is going on the nose on the last wine you poured us here?
This is a 2020 Bockstein, which is the name of the vineyard site. This is also a Grand Cru vineyard, a große Lage, and it's a Cabinet. So it's not a großes Gewächs because it's not dry. And Cabinet is a very unique, very typical wine for German Riesling, a typical wine style, especially here in the Mosel. It means that the grapes are picked at a perfect ripeness level, but not overripe. Not still green anymore, but perfect. And at that point, the potential alcohol or the sugar content in the grape is just enough, if you made the wine totally dry, to reach as much as maybe 10% alcohol. That would be very, very little, of course. What we do is we leave a touch of natural residual sugar, which brings the alcohol level even further down, because not all the sugar of the grape is fermented into alcohol. Some stays as residual sugar. So you have only, like in this case, 7% alcohol. This wine is only 7%. That's a specialty, and still it has so much power. It's so tasteful. And you don't really taste the sweetness, because it's residual sweetness. It's a lot of it is fructose, which is a very elegant, refined sugar. And thanks to the sweetness, thanks to the acidity and also the salinity from the minerals, this wine tastes perfectly balanced. Mm-hmm. I call this the margarita effect. It's like when you have a margarita cocktail with the salt on a glass, when the salt kicks in, the acidity doesn't taste sour. It tastes almost sparkling, and the sweetness doesn't taste cloying or sticky. The sweetness disappears. The cocktail finishes off almost dry, and that's such a fascinating taste impression that margaritas are, you know, that makes margaritas so popular, I guess. And it's what you get in a good Riesling from the Mosel, or in this case from the Saar. This is also from the Saar.
Okay.
And this is, Bockstein is one of the best Riesling vineyards in the world. It's just a fantastic vineyard, and this is a textbook Cabinet Vintage 2020. And you were asking me about the nose. What you get here is a complex, high-resolution flavor spectrum of anything you can wish for in a wine. There's not just fruit, not just a few fruit elements. It's not a juice. Wine is culturally on a much higher level than juice. So, of course, there should be some fruit elements, especially in a Riesling, but there's much more than that. There's some earthiness, smokiness. I always call it the thunderstorm smell, when the first raindrops fall in the summer after a long, hot, and dry day, and the first raindrops fall on the ground, evaporate, and you get that beautiful smell, and you smell the earth, you smell the herbs, you also smell, maybe the ancient ethereal oils of herbs that have deteriorated on the surface, and those oils got into the stone, and they come out because the rain, you know, brings it out again, the evaporation of the rain brings it out again. And then you get some also herbal notes, almost like the herbs that you smell in an intact vineyard, where you have built a nice soil biome that has built itself, but that you have supported to build, where you have a lot of different herbs that all contribute to the smell that you get in a vineyard. Then you get also some almost funky or
the funky.
I call it brothy notes or brazy notes, like braised meat. This is something. Braised meat is like a bizarre analogy in a wine, but it's something that you get from the fermentation. You know, yeasts are living beings, and they have a metabolism, and they produce similar flavors that you also get in other food, so to speak. When you eat meat that is cooked in any way, I'll think of a broth, a soup, or something. And then there are all these other elements that you would also find in a broth, like some vegetable notes, vegetative notes from root vegetables like carrots and celery. And you find spicy elements like peppery notes, clove, bay leaf, nutmeg, or things like that. You find notes that are reminiscent of flowers, floral notes, like especially here you get the lilac, elderflower, violets, roses, lavender, all that. And all that together creates what I just call the high-resolution flavor spectrum. It's so fascinating that you can't stop smelling and drinking it, and that's what makes it so quaffable, appealing.
You were saying before about there's some wines, the party wines, which are incredibly important. At the same time, the wines where you sit there and you're contemplating, and then this is certainly that. But you want to pour a bunch of this at a party, that's a party I would like to be at. I would take this over margaritas at Margaritaville anytime. Apologies to Jimmy Buffett. When your father decided to invest in St. Catharines and Niagara and that area, I don't know if he ever told you about it, but what was the reaction around here about, what do you mean you're going to go and do a relationship with Ontario? Because even today, Ontario wine is still fairly unknown. But back then in the 70s, as you mentioned, it's the land of Concord grapes.
Well, first, people didn't really notice because he didn't tell anybody about it. Yeah. He just did it. Yeah. That's the way he was.
Yeah.
And then when people found out about it, I don't know if it is a lack of geographical knowledge or if it is superficiality, but they mixed it up with California. Canada and California both starts with a K. So, you know, they thought they didn't know whether it is Canada or whether it is California. They just mixed it up. And so they didn't really know. Those people who knew, they probably thought, this is Canada in the 1970s, 1980s, they probably thought this is like almost polar circle for viticulture. That would be difficult. But it worked because the Niagara Peninsula has a very special climate with the onshore winds and being squeezed in between Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, which keep the peninsula warm. And it's still in terms of latitude more southern than the Mosel, but of course on the North American continent on the east side that doesn't count much. But it also got warmer and warmer, and I think like most cool climate regions, or northern wine regions, also Canada benefits from global warming. I don't consider that as something that makes me happy. I mean, global warming is definitely a problem, and I would rather like not to have it. But so far, in certain ways, we've benefited from it. On the other hand, weather extremes are getting more. So I don't know if it's good or bad. So
That's always such a hard one. But yeah, the idea that England can make dry red wine kind of scares me a little bit in terms of climate change. Actually, we'll stay on that theme for a second. This quote from you about sustainability. And you say, when people ask me about my idea of sustainability, I always say when you're doing viticulture in a vineyard that's 1,800 years old, you don't want to be the idiot who ruins it. So I'm wondering if you could expand on that quote.
Here are vineyards where people are doing viticulture since the second or third century after Christ. And when you think about all that history, I mean, how many generations have been working in such a vineyard, cultivating vines? You know that you are just one little speck on a long timeline, and you don't want to be the last speck. And you want to pass on that land in best possible shape to the next generation. But also, a vineyard like that deserves more than just being a wine producing agricultural surface. A vineyard like that has made so many people happy by producing wine for them. I think it deserves to make the best possible wine in there, and also the most unique wine, a wine that is possible to be produced only in that vineyard site with that particular character that vineyard brings. That's my goal. And when people ask me about sustainability, I say, yes, we are sustainable. We are working sustainable. We are even certified sustainable by a German certification system called Fair and Green. And but I say, working sustainable is something self-evident, or that should be self-evident for a winemaker. First of all, you don't want to cut off the branch in which you're seeding. Also, you build a legacy, and you want to pass on your work to the next generation. But also, if you want to make good wine, you have to work with nature and not against it. I mean, you don't have to be a tree hugger to be an organic grower. You got to be organic in order to make great wines.
Yeah, that's the point, is that you don't need to have a certificate. You don't need to have a marketing campaign saying, look how organic and sustainable it is. It's look how good this wine is. Look how healthy the vines are. Look what we're doing here. You know, you might not have 1,000 certificates, but the wine itself and the vines around you kind of screams, we are doing things the right way here.
Well, viticulture means it's a culture. So what is a culture? In my opinion, in a culture, people are doing special things, great things, and especially when they're doing it with nature, which means people can use nature to achieve something more than they could achieve all alone without nature. And it's also something that people help nature to achieve more than it could do on its own. If you go to a forest and you listen to the sound that the wind makes when it blows through the trees, or maybe a hole in a tree or a hole in a branch, there's a sound. It's a, maybe even a tone. Maybe it's a clear tone. Is it music? No, it's not music. Not yet. Nature can't really do music the way we know it. But when you go and cut a special tree and cut boards from it, and you build a violin, a fiddle or whatever, let's say a violin from it, then you have created an instrument with which you can play the most fantastic music that would have never played on this planet if man hadn't done this together with nature. And it's the same with a grape that falls off a wild vine. It falls maybe on a hollow stone and it splashes, and then you have grape juice in that hollow, and then it starts to ferment, and it's, yeah, technically wine. Is it good wine? Probably not. But if men take vines and cultivate them, protect them from competitors, and support it by giving them the right treatment, the right support, the right nutrients, the right soil cultivation, all that, you can grow fantastic grapes. And if you turn them into wine in a proper way with the right tools that men have created, then you can make a wine that without man, nature would not have been able to produce, but without nature and without divine, man would not be able to produce this.
You need that relationship.
That's what culture means.
Yeah,
that's what viticulture is. And if you think that through to the very end, you know exactly what you have to do to make things right.
Yeah, and you have to treat nature right, or else you're not going to get a good wine. And it's a perfect relationship between both sides. That's really well a good way to put it. I'll ask you about the notions of minerality in a second, because it's always so controversial, just minerality. But I don't know if there was another wine to pour. I don't know if you can do better than this. I don't know if there was another one, or do we just move on?
Do you want me to talk about minerality first, or pour the next wine first?
We'll pour the next wine,
all right.
And we'll do with minerality. Thank you, sir. And we're back. So first, real quick, what did you pour for us? And again, Nick, thank you so much. It's a wonderful tasting so far.
Oh, you're welcome. This is 2018. It's a Spätlese. Spät means late. Lese means to pick. So it's a late pick from a vineyard site called Goldtröpfchen, which means little golden drops. And that's located in Peaceport. And everybody knows Peaceporter. And this is the vineyard that made Peaceport famous, that created the great name of that town before the production and marketing of mass wines. For a certain while, a certain period of time, kind of doomed the image of Peaceport, and now it is on its way back big time. Of course, there's still also Peaceporter around that is of, let's say, simpler fashion, but when you buy a Goldtröpfchen from an estate winery that has a certain reputation, a good reputation, you get usually a wonderful wine and a wonderful representative for that vineyard.
Yeah, intense honey, intense ripe tropical fruit. I mean, the spice, the savor. It's a pretty impressive wine. I think if I was just, I would just call it that. And for people thinking sweet, you're not. Yeah, the acidity is just this linear acidity that's just, you know, tracking this entire wine.
Well, it's that mix of savoriness and fruitiness and sweetness. Just like on a ham and pineapple pizza.
Yep.
The savoriness of the ham and the
I'm going to say right now, I've never heard a high-end Spätlese described as a ham and pineapple pizza. That is a new one for me.
Yeah, but that's
it. Works.
That's the play.
Yeah.
That's what the savoriness of the slate soil and the fruitiness of the grape variety together. What they do is it's like you know, a lot of food picks that up. Like think of the, you know, bacon and maple syrup, or dried plums wrapped in bacon and fried, or think of sweet and sour pork, you know, or miso glazed cod, you know, a lot of the things that Asian fusion cuisine puts on the plate works that way, and there's nothing negative about it. It's the opposite. I mean, these wines, in terms of sweetness, step back as they age because the sugar molecules, they polymerize, and then they build longer chains of carbohydrates. It's still the same amount after a while of calories, if you want, so, or of sugar. And it's not a lot. It's not like these wines have a tremendous amount of calories or more calories than a dry wine.
Right.
I don't know, a dry Chardonnay or something. It's just when the wine ages, the form of sugar changes, and these longer chains of carbs, they give less sweetness to the palate, but they add to the mouthfeel, to the body, to the let's say creaminess and structure of the wine. That's what happens when a wine ages. So after a while it ends up tasting almost dry, even though there has been, like, I don't know, 40, 50, or 60 grams per liter residual sugar.
That's nuts. Some just some minty, herby things. By the way, I don't know if you can see it, but the girls around the table, they're like swooning. This wine makes you swoon. So then we'll end on this because we've hit an hour. We could go on and on, but there's always, and I wanted to ask you this because just I was doing some research and just the ideas of minerality come up, and everyone argues and fights about it. And some people say, no, minerality is a thing. Others say, no, that's just used by sommeliers to sound smart. I'm curious, you know, when you think about German Riesling, just the idea of minerality or saline, like these terms are thrown around all the time. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Minerality or a mineral character is quite of an abstract term when it comes to wine. And everybody has his own picture about that taste in a wine. What is mineral, or what is a mineral character? Some people associate the nose with minerals, like I mentioned earlier, when a wine has this thunderstorm smell, the wet stone, wet soil smell, that can be kind of a mineral character in a flavor sense of the word. But minerals don't have a flavor because minerals are salt, and salt is not volatile. It is nothing that gives a scent. There's no ethereal ways of a mineral to evaporate and get into your nose. So minerals usually don't smell like much because salt doesn't smell like much. But in a soil, of course, there are so many other components besides the minerals that can give a certain smell. And also, minerals consist of also metal, and metal has usually on a lot of chemical reactions, also biochemical reactions, a certain catalytic effect. So the flavor production in the berries, in the grapes, as well as the flavor production in the yeast during fermentation is very much influenced by the metals in the soil, by the soil compositions, by the fact or the idea what minerals you have, what minerals mineral composition you have in the soil. So that has an effect on the flavor. In terms of mouthfeel, what I consider as a mineral is, for some people, it's the acidity. They got a very steely acidity, and they say, oh, this is like minerals. And that's okay. I leave everyone with his own word and his own description alone, that this is something that you personally, for you, decide how you want to call a certain taste impression and what your word is for that. There's no rule, in my opinion, and there should be nobody who says, no, this is, you're wrong with your impression, this is not mineral. Mineral is so it's mineral character, something totally different. No. If this is your impression, you want to use that word, this is your description of the wine. Talking about wine is a little bit like it's a little bit poetic. It's a little bit an art. And if you talk about the wine the way you want, it's like you sing the song the way you want. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you should do it. Me personally, I think a lot about minerals when I get a salinity in the wine, just like you get in very salty mineral water that has a lot of mineral content that makes you want to swallow and drink it, and you know that is appealing, that is animating. Slate puts a lot of that salinity into a wine, that salt character, and this play between soil and the acidity of Riesling. That's actually quite nice. This is actually also what in great cuisine is used, that element of salty and acidic in a good sauce. Just think of a Blanc Blanc, a white wine sauce, or just think of, yeah, like I mentioned before, the Asian fusion cuisine. We have savory and sweet in one. And that's also what you get. So that's for me mineral. It's a salty impression on the palate, but also a rather earthy note in the flavors in the nose especially.
Nick, this has been fantastic. Every wine has been just completely representative of what this area is supposed to be at its highest level. I mean, congratulations at the age of 29 with the VDP and everything that you have done since then. This has been wonderful.
Thank you very much.
And when I'm putting this out, I'll mention wines that are available. How many of these, or any of these, is it difficult to find these wines in Ontario or Quebec, places like that?
Well, if you fly Air Canada at the moment and you want to give you a treat and fly business class, currently Air Canada pours one of my QBAs, one of my entry level wines. It's called the Urban Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
The Urban, Saint Urban, Sestate, Urban.
Urban yep.
Riesling. This is currently poured in Air Canada. Also, you can find the wines in the LCBO in Ontario and I don't want to say all over Canada, but we are in many provinces from British Columbia, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, to all the way to Quebec. You find our wines. Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. Nick, congratulations on everything and wish you nothing but continued success.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me at Stitcher, Audio Boom, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.